not here yet, and so I was asked if I would start. I'm Nancy Carson. I'm ready to be the chair. We do not yet have a quorum, so we cannot vote on anything, but we can start some of the business along the way. Rather than postponing it any longer. Again, I'm Nancy Carson. Do any of you people want to introduce yourself, or do you feel confident with each other? Harvey, are you enjoying your email?
I'll introduce myself since I'm here. My name is Daniel Schwartz. I'm representing the taxpayers, which is kind of scary, because I guess that means there's like 6 million people counting on me, but I'll try to do my best.
Well, I'll take my own representation.
But I'm new to the board. I was also a member of the board of the Downtown Bid and Central City Association, and they proposed my name a couple of months ago, and I guess this is the end of the process. Just nice to be here.
Welcome, Dan.
Harvey Berg from Valley College.
Kurt Tennyson from Los Angeles City College.
Camille Goulet, I'm the district's general counsel.
I'm the other new person in the room. I'm Lloyd Silverstein.
Say it again, please.
I'm Lloyd Silverstein. I'm the new program director for Bill Daley CCD.
Okay.
I'm Todd Cozzolino with Bill Daley CCD Construction.
Tom Hall, I'm with the district office.
Larry Eisenberg, LA CCD Facilities.
Excuse me, I'm identified at all with the deputy chancellor.
Again, I'm Nancy Carson. I represent Harvard College.
Donna Smith, Pierce College.
Bob Courtney, I represent Foundations.
Henry Porter, Southwest College.
Flora Lynn Johnson, I coordinate the DCOC activities, and I work at Mary's office and facility.
Ms. Carson, you may want to, if there are people who want to speak, they may want to speak now, or they may want to wait until a forum is convened, and I would recommend that you give them the opportunity to make that choice.
I have no problem with that recommendation. Are there any public speakers?
We agree. Sure.
What is your choice?
Well, depends on when you're going to. Obviously, I guess you're not going to take any action unless you have a quorum to consider your annual report. You want to speak mainly on the annual report and somewhat on Bandcamp, which will probably come as necessary to you.
So, your answer?
We'll wait for a quorum, I guess.
All right, thank you.
But if you get the Bandicam, you may want to see
that.
Well, you'll have your one opportunity to speak, so we'll see what we get to first.
Yeah. Well, obviously you're aware that our two interests are the annual report and Bandicams, so.
I may be incorrect, and I certainly welcome to be corrected, but I know usually public speakers speak to all the topics that they're interested in at the same time.
No.
I'm not sure that we're going to get a quorum, so waiting may not be prudent. But my suggestion would be to have public speakers now.
I'm open to any suggestions.
Well, I think that if you're going to commence with the consideration of items that you're going to vote upon, then you can, and the speakers want to address that item, then they can do that. But in the absence of a quorum, you're going to be able to vote on it anyway. So I would suggest that you proceed with your agenda, and that the speakers have indicated their interest in speaking to the annual report and to the Bandicamp item in particular, that when you come up with that agenda, the first agenda item, that they get the first part, they get their 5 minutes
at that time.
At that time.
Or the one that they choose to use.
Yeah.
All right. Any other public speakers who wish to speak now? I guess we'll have to wait on the minutes. It's approval for the meeting date. Suggested, as far as I can see, unless somebody feels differently. How about a program update, number 6?
And Todd Cozzolino from Bill Daley CCD is going to present the program update.
Okay.
I'll be speaking from this package, the one that starts with the colorful graph, the bar chart.
And that is?
It's right under that memo, changing.
It looks like the.
It's all I picked up.
Is it in here? Thank you.
Does everybody have a copy of this? We have additional copies over there.
Is this packet?
No.
Oh, you handed out. You're right here then.
Okay.
So I don't get that.
This is how the tables were listed.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Anybody else?
Did you get one? Here, you need yours, and you have one.
Okay.
Yeah, I'll leave one for now.
Okay, so starting with the cover page with the blue bar charts. What this is an overview of our Division of State Architect closeout activity. So as you may know, the Division of State Architect is a state agency that has to approve any designs of projects that the community college intends to build. And an ongoing effort, and sometimes a challenge for some community college districts, and as well for that matter, is the closeout and certification of active projects, and even historical and legacy projects for a district. So it's really critical in a bond program of this size, when you have so many projects seeking approval from the ESA, to have legacy projects, and even, in our case, AAA projects that were completed, closed out and certified in order to get additional projects certified in the future. So in the last approximately 2 years, we've started a major initiative to make sure that projects are closed out completely and with certification, because there's a way to close out a project without certification, which is not good and something to avoid. So what you see here are metrics as to the status of our DSA submissions and our DSA projects. Starting from the left, closure with certification. That means we designed a building, submitted to DSA for approval, and then actually built it and demonstrated to DSA that we completed it for what we said we were going to do. Closed it, and now it's a part of the capital, you know, assets of the campus. And you'll see the leftmost column is that number of projects. Avoid or canceled projects is projects that have either gotten redefined or absorbed as AA passed after A. We wanted to revisit the size of that project or something. You may void an A number, an application number, and then reintroduce it under a new, different project. So void and canceled projects are represented there, and those are really no problem because they've been superseded by a subsequent application. Closed without certification, the middle bar. That is something to avoid. These are the problems for districts in order to maintain a capital program from a design approval standpoint. And I'll talk in a minute about what constitutes that 2% that remain closed without certification. Projects under construction pending closeout, you wouldn't expect them to be certified because they're not done yet. They have DSA approvals, but they're in process. So that represents the activity that's going on in each of our campuses. And then pending approval are designs that we've completed and submitted to DSA for approval and are being reviewed currently by DSA. So looking back at the metric we want to avoid, which is closed without certification, you'll see that 2% of the 915 projects represent 17 projects. Six are considered pre-bond projects, which are also referred to as legacy projects, which may date back until the 30s and 40s conceivably. Projects that are older, but largely you have a 90-day window after occupancy of a building to certify a building, to get all the change orders in, to get all the deferred submittals in, and actually have DSA go through the process of reviewing and approving it. So there's us and there's them with regard to what needs to happen in order to certify. Six of those fall into that category. So those are closed without certification. They would be reopened and closed once whatever outstanding things need to occur happen. The remaining 11 out of the 17 are, as you see, I'm reading from the language on the bottom, await future work to be performed or demolished under Prop J.
So in some cases, a building will be adjacent to another building that involves path of travel, for example. That DSA wants to say, okay, how do you get from here to there? You may have temporary path of travel, but they won't finally certify a specific project until you maintain a permanent path of travel for that purpose. That's the typical reason why one project will be contingent on the completion of another project. The other is demolition of an existing building that may or may not be compliant. So it's just how the existing buildings interface with the projects that have previously been defined to DSA exist. So this is a large-scale overlook of where we are with regard to DSA. And this is, you know, we've initiated a lot of efforts to incentivize completion of this, including punitive measures against architects and designers who fail to follow up at the end of a project and close it out with DSA because they have a large portion of the responsibility in doing that. Yes, sir.
What is the form of documentation you get from DSA? In the market world, you get a certificate of occupancy from the local building department. What documentation you get from DSA saying that this is certified in the event of liability, in the event of anything?
It's in fact a letter of certification of the building associated with an open A number that's issued to Larry on the specific project. So
okay.
It's a letter, basically.
And the other thing I'm having some difficulty with is you're saying that a completed capital project under the bond issue, a brand new building, is they hold it contingent upon something happening between it and an existing building. Is that what I understood you to say?
If a new building changes a path of travel or changes a that component of a site, then they may want to say, okay, you haven't done this building yet adjacent to it.
Yeah.
You want to do this building, but we want to make sure when you do that building, the change, say the path of travel went through the new footprint of the building you're seeking approval on.
Well, I would challenge that on the grounds that, number one, we have to know the historical background of that existing building. That existing building may be a pre-ADA compliant building. In other words, it doesn't comply anyway. So why hold this building up because of something over there? Have we ever challenged that?
It's really a case-by-case basis with the projects. And, you know, depending on the case, it could be a situation where the path of travel has a building in front of it now. And until you effectuate your master plan of creating new access to that part, it won't be final. But they'll still approve the plans for construction, but sometimes there's a gap at the end when you're finally certifying until you move on to that next project and complete it, where they create a relationship between the two certifications.
But the liability you assume, here's the liability you assume, the district assume, is that when you have people occupying a building that doesn't have certification, you open yourself up to a lot of liability.
That is
if someone get injured in there, if there's a fire in there, you know, whatever tragedy may happen in that building, you have no proof of being in there legally, legitimately. That's the major concern that I see with this whole situation of how you're allowing DSA to do this.
The issue really is not so much, and I'm not really aware of any situation where we have a whole building that's in question like that. Because typically for our new buildings, we are in fact getting them certified and
Sure. Fine.
The issue has been typically for remodel projects where we change a segment of a building.
Mm-hmm.
We take it from a classroom into a laboratory space or vice versa.
Okay.
And those individual little projects then also need to be closed out.
Mm-hmm.
But historically had not been in some cases. And yet, so at Southwest College, for example, the Cox Building is case in point where we had several little projects over the last 20 years go on in that building. Number of those projects were never closed out.
Okay.
And so the building itself is certified as being safe, but those individual project spaces have not been, the paperwork's not finished for those particular areas. And what DSA does as punishment for that is that now we want to go in the Cox Building to do a comprehensive remodel. They will not allow us to begin our project until those old projects are certified and closed out to do that. That's how they hold our feet to the fire to have that happen. So that's this 17 projects that we're looking at is not closed out, have that issue. The issue becomes sort of difficult, and actually DSA is working on a statewide basis to resolve this issue because their standards have been very precise, And for example, one of the things that they want is a final signature of the architect on the final form. And so when you have an architectural firm that has gone out of business and the architect has moved out of the state, it may be impossible to find them to do that signature. And so then at the moment in for DSA, they just leave the project open, but you know, all we're missing is the signature of that missing architect to do that. So DSA now is getting ready to implement procedures that will allow us to overcome that kind of obstacle when the space in fact has been built according to the code and been inspected and is really quite suitable, then the idea that there's no reason why it should be held out as not certified in that kind of way. So that's really the nature of the issue that we face on these. And literally in a couple cases, we had situations where we need a signature of the contractor, the inspector of record, the architect, to close out the project. And in some cases, those people have actually passed away.
Okay.
And then, I mean, of course, we won't be able to get a signature in that situation. So the idea that DSA needs to be lenient and what they're actually doing is change their rules so that we can overcome that kind of issue. So these projects have issues associated with them that, you know, we've taken them, we've done a really great job, because when we began, when I came to the district in 2003, we had something like 800 projects that were not closed out from pre-bond activity of little remodels that had happened, individual buildings, and we've attack those in a significant way now. And now we're down to the point where out of everything that we've done, both the several hundred bond program projects and the legacy projects, we're down to 17 that we have yet to finish at this point. And now with DSA's help, we'll be able to wrap this up and we'll be in good shape. And we're probably the only district at the moment in California that has this good of a record in terms of doing this.
Just one final question. Is there any impact upon the sunset in terms of the expenditures from the bond money? So if some of these things drag on and on and on, what kind of impact are we going to have from that?
Yeah, good question. We're required basically 90 days after final project completion to make final payment.
Okay.
We release the retainage that we've been holding on the contractor and now the architect to do that. So what we've actually done, one of the reasons for success that we've been having on our new projects is that we implemented retainage on the architect with the idea that they have to finish the paperwork before we give them their final payment.
Okay.
So typically then we make the architect responsible for that activity, and that's facilitated closing out all of our active projects in a good way. So we haven't had that issue.
Okay.
So we're really pretty clean in terms of payment, and we're required by law, because if we fail to pay, then the state law provides for a interest payment calculation where we start to pay interest on the money we have withheld inappropriately to do that. So we've been avoiding that and have that happen. The only case where we still might hold money is if we have a legitimate dispute. And so we believe that there's some quality issue, some error was made or something, that we still hold money on to address that issue. But otherwise, we clean it up within that 90-day period.
Thank you.
Is there ever a provisional elements of this approval, so at least we can maybe shore up the legal side of this to where we're provisionally approved, subject to maybe one or two sub-elements, as you were saying, or is it either all or nothing?
It really is sort of an all or nothing, but we do not move into a building unless our inspectors have signed off in particular, and they're inspecting for the life safety issues, for our structural safety and our ADA compliance to do that. So once the inspector signs off, then our feeling has been that it is safe to take occupancy of the building at that point, and we have a record, of course, of their approval of that. So although the building may not be finally certified by DSA, by the point in time that people are moving in, by the time we're 90 days past point of completion, building closed. So I don't think we have any existing bond buildings that we've completed that we've not now closed in a timely way.
Are these inspectors independent contractors? Or
yes.
Are they part of the organization?
Well, we have a very small internal district staff, literally three people. My chief deputy for inspection, who reports to me, and he has a couple of senior inspectors, and the three of them coordinate our entire inspection program, and there are about 90 contractor inspectors out there who are working on our projects, because under state law, we're required to have real-time inspection, which means that someone has to be there watching as the concrete is poured and the steel goes up and all of that.
Which is great. So we're somewhat indemnified by their insurance coverage, you know what I mean?
Absolutely.
I think it's important, though, to make the distinction. DSA certification of completion is not certification of occupancy. Totally different thing.
Oh.
They shouldn't be mixed up with the private sector at all. There's no relationship at all. It's common, it's done statewide. You move into a building based on what your inspectors and the architects say. It passes, as Larry said, it passes your fire life safety, you're in. And it's not uncommon to have buildings for years or decades that are not DSA certified. That's an important distinction.
Thank you.
Okay.
Another incentive model that exists for designers to follow through at the close of the project is the ineligibility for additional work until they follow up on the projects that they already have with the district. That's been a major key after it was rolled out to achieve this kind of result and use it as leverage to, you know, bring it the rest of the way on. So moving on to the second page, this is it's got a yellow bar at the top. It says recent bid activity stats. This sheet is for our design bid build, or also known as low bid projects. Just a snapshot in history since the last meeting of low bid construction activity. So what you have is the name of the project, the engineer's estimate or the district's estimate of what the project would cost in the second column. All the way at the right is the actual bid amount of the successful proposer.
This is different.
A few to note, the fourth one down, Learning Assistance Center Library Renovation at LA Trade Tech College, you'll see the difference between the district's estimate and the actual bid amount is substantial in kind of the trend,
yeah,
as we've been reporting for some time now.
Right.
Is that just based on the economic situation in construction right now?
There's a lot of competition, and people know that the numbers are arriving at that. With all of these, we vet the fact that the numbers, the bids that we receive are within a certain range of each other. So within 5% is usually our benchmark to make sure that they didn't miss something. And if we do note that, we'll bring the contractors in and interview them about, you know, are you comfortable with this number? Did you see the other bids? Can you do this project? And on some occasions, they say, no, we made a clerical error. But in the cases where we move forward with them, you know, it's actually remarkable. For example, parking structure 4 at ELAC, that's about halfway down. $19 million budget, $12 million bid, and I think all of the 19 bids were within maybe 6%. Which is a very tight cluster.
What's the explanation for the flooring in Franken Hall from $320,000 to $638,000? It's the only one that's up.
It's kind of an anomaly. I don't know. I don't know the answer to that.
I may have changed materials or something like that, but
quite possibly. And you know, sometimes it's an estimating issue.
Mm-hmm. It's an old building, so they may have other problems.
That's true. And renovations are sometimes hard to price, hard to estimate risk. And contractors' perception of risk on renovation projects.
Do these bid amounts allow for some variance in actuality, such as for add-ons or for variances of any kind, plus or minus 5% type of thing? These pretty much fixed numbers, hard fixed numbers? They won't go over the bid amount?
The contract that we execute based on their bid is a fixed number. It's a lump sum cost for the plans and specifications that we issue. The basis of change orders is typically unforeseen conditions. There's something in the ground that you didn't tell me was there. Problem with the error with the plans or specifications that the contractor said, I bid on these plans and specs, and the owner represents to the contractor that they're buildable, and in fact, there's an issue with that. That's another grounds for a modification of the contract to the change order. A third would be a request for change from the owner. But absent those things that have to be demonstrated by the contractor, that's a hard number that we hold them to for the project we issue.
Are we subject to the same kind of moving city approval requirements that I am as a private developer? That's always a change order issue for
We don't have the typical municipal inspections. As Larry said, we have the continuous inspection by DSA-certified inspectors. And they really inspect against the DSA-approved plan, so there's usually not too many surprises on what they're looking for, because it's in the contract.
So if we have a savings, I mean, I'm going to ask a ridiculous question here. If we have a savings, is there any chance that money will go back to the taxpayers, or is it get used in something else? I assume we get a little humor out of this, but...
But we actually, if you recall the way that the bond measure worked on Measure J, that the list that we presented to the voters actually assumed that we'd be able to fund only part of the list. And part of the projects would be future opportunity, or if we save money, we'd fund those subsequent projects. So that's the mode that we're in at the moment, is that we actually have the opportunity now to move down the list a little bit and pick up another project we did not think we could complete.
That's a good answer. I like it.
Yeah. So the voters are getting, taxpayers are getting more value for their dollar.
Good.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's a summary of our design bid build projects, where we fully design it, put it on the street, and receive a low bid for a project and award a contract. The next series of pages, starting with this black and white table, entitled LACC Design Build Step 1 Pre-Qualification, is the results of our design build initiative. We annually, since 2008, when Prop J was initiated, through this year, publicly advertise a pre-qualification opportunity for design build teams to participate on our program. This is a design build, briefly, is just a packaging of the design and construction activities to a team of architects and contractors working together. So what this table is the responses we received to the 2010 version of the pre-qualification publication, and also the historical context of the number of submissions we've gotten. The reduction in responses is really just a function of the fact that many of them are already established. Many of the ones that are going to pre-qualify are already established on our pre-qualified list. So that's basically a snapshot of the industry participation on our design build program. Moving to the next staple packet, which is in color, is the backup to that summary, which is the actual responses and scores that were issued to each of the design build teams. So it's broken down by category, which is the project type that we may ask them to compete on, general classroom and administration by dollar amount. And then we have things like parking structures, sports facilities, specific project typologies that we want to pre-qualify a specific skill set with that team for. And you'll see the team that we pre-qualify is the general contractor, the architect of record as the two leads. And then under the architect of record would be the structural, electrical, and mechanical engineer subdisciplines, and the electrical, mechanical, and plumbing subcontractor as a subcontracting team. So those comprise the pre-qualified team that participate in our design build effort.
So if they qualify, then you offer them to bid on certain projects, is that the idea?
Yes, this is done on a district-wide basis. Right. And as individual projects are identified by the campuses and program, they're issued to the relevant pool. So say a specific college has a parking structure, we summarize the project, issue it to the parking structure pool, and they respond with their qualifications for the specific requirements of that project. They're shortlisted on the basis of qualifications, which includes personnel, project experience, references, things of that nature. And then that shortlisted pool moves on to the design build competition, which is a step 3 RFP, where they submit a design and a price for that project.
And they're paid for those designs, aren't they?
Unsuccessful
submissions?
Unsuccessful proposers on that last step, the design effort and the bidding effort, are paid an honorarium.
Honorarium, right.
Yes.
Which is it's important. It's a very small fraction of the cost.
But I did notice, I think, if looking back historically in the paperwork, that some of them were pretty large numbers.
The
honorariums were like $1 million. I don't know why. remember some big numbers.
I don't think so.
No, no.
We are paying typically a half of 1% of the project cost as an honorarium.
Actually, two-tenths of 1%,
that's right.
Two-tenths of a percent.
Which is based on a lot of industry, public industry.
Then my memory is not right.
So in context, on a $100 million project, that would be a $200,000 type in, you know.
If you have 10 people or 5 people bidding to that.
We usually shortlist the 3 firms, so two would be paid. One would get the project, and the design work would be used in the project.
You minimize that honorarium cost.
Do we have incentives and penalties as part of the contract?
We have penalties, basically liquidated damages for late completion.
Yes.
As far as incentives, we have a contracting model that's called a cost plus guaranteed maximum price that has a shared savings provision in it.
Okay.
Whereas if they, under that contracting model, bring in the project less than they originally anticipated, we share in the savings that they've identified. But typically it's a lump sum contract, which is more traditional. Mm-hmm. And there's no bonuses or incentives for early completion. I don't think we could do that.
Have you had any come in under contract where you actually did that?
You know, we haven't got to the completion level of a cost plus guaranteed maximum price contract yet. So we wouldn't have got into the contingency evaluation. It's kind of it's not used very often. It's really the lump sum model that is more typical.
Yeah. Typically, if I may, typically to offer a bonus for early completion, there needs to be some significant public purpose at play. For example, you may recall when the 10 freeway went down after the earthquake, mm-hmm. the impact on the city was enormous, and so there was a legitimate public purpose in incentivizing earlier completion compared to other, but sometimes there are other situations, and one of the good examples would be the inception of classes or something.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, if we chose to do that, we can include things like additive alternates in the original competition for a shorter time frame.
Yeah.
But there's ways we can incentivize that. And the final item on here is the design build snapshot, it's called. This is the status of all the design build projects in the district, including awarded to date. If you look on the first page, it starts with Weston. Almost the entire front page and onto the second page are all awarded contracts. These are Proposition J. Funded design build projects, all executed since November 2008. So we were fortunate enough to hit the market and contract a lot of scope during a very beneficial time to do so. So this is maintained, all these documents are maintained on the build.ccd website and are updated very frequently.
Completes our presentation.
Are there any other questions?
Well done.
Well done. Thank you very much. All right. What's this? Multiplier? To discuss it?
That is a really concise.
That was well done.
Yeah, excellent. Keep it up.
Okay. Do we have a vote on multiplier? I believe it's an information item, isn't it?
That's just an information item.
Watch
correct.
It.
Right.
Yeah. It's discussions in the agenda.
Yeah, you have the background memo on the multiplier and the board resolution that was passed as well. And I'm going to ask Mr. Silverstein to provide a little bit of background on and just refresh your memory on the multiplier issue, and then we'd be glad to respond to any questions that you have.
Well, the board did pass a resolution to cap the multiplier for the program management firm at two some time ago, and there were subsequent actions to get approval from the board to make contract amendment. That hasn't actually happened yet, but that's in play. And actually, the program manager has been billing at the 2.0 cap since the resolution passed.
Oh, good.
I think the bigger issue is, and I think that's what Larry might be referring to, is we're looking at the compensation approach for all professional services firms to get a more consistent approach instead of doing it piecemeal. and that's under the waiver.
So the multiplier issue is the idea that for the consultants that we have on board, in particular those consultants that work for us through the Build LACCD program, that the individual is employed by a home company. Many of them are employed by URS as the leader of our Build LACCD team. And URS would pay their employee a take-home salary. And that becomes the starting point for the calculation of what's allowed to be billed. And then that employee receives fringe benefits, typically a health package of some kind, retirement, vacation, sick leave, and so on, that all have costs associated with them. Then the company that's providing that employee to us has expenses as a company, where they have someone who's on their accounting staff, someone who's handling taxes for them. They have office space that they've been using to do their work. And then there are reimbursable expenses for the employee, for the company, that they may be entitled to. That the combination of these several different expenses constitute the multiplier, and what the board's action has done is basically said that we take that employee's take-home salary, we multiply it by two, and the company can charge us that number as the basis for compensation plus 10% on top of that for profit. Because everything within that so-called overhead component of fringe benefits and retirement and so on is all actual costs that the company bears. And so the only profit they're making is the extra 10% under the board resolution that you have in the packet that basically allows them to make the profit on the work that they do for us. So that's the basis. The thing that looks somewhat odd and has been a topic of conversation is the idea that we can have someone who takes home $100,000 a year, perhaps, and then the company would bill us $200,000, and the question is, well, why do we pay so much money? Well, because that $100,000 employee has other expenses associated with their being in that particular company to do that. And when one thinks about it, the idea that if a district employee were looked at in that kind of way, that I have my salary that I take home, then I have my fringe benefits, my retirement, and that come with all of that. And then there are a broad range of people who work in the district who support me. So we have a payroll staff, an accounting staff, contracts people, procurement people, human resource people. Those are all part of the district overhead, if you will. It's part of that. So the LA Times in particular, in their inquiry that's been ongoing for our program, continues to raise the issue that we're paying too much for employee compensation. And the reality is we're following exactly now the resolution approved by the board, or that provides for the 2.0 limitation with a 10% profit, and that's it. Because I think if one did the calculation for a district employee, you'd probably find that the multiplier for district employees is probably higher than 2.0.
Yes, it is.
As well.
So the reality is that by hiring contractors, that in fact we're saving money, and I think being of value to the taxpayer again in terms of how the program's being managed, beyond of course the fact that Proposition 39 specifically said that we cannot use bond money to pay the salaries of administrators in the district. Mm-hmm. And we've held to that in a very rigorous way, so that we do not use bond money to pay district employees salary expenses, whatever.
How do you control feather bedding, you know, people having more employees under this program than they necessarily need? Which would obviously pump up all these numbers. How do you avoid that? Do you audit that? Do you approve it? Do you approve these employees? I mean, how is that controlled? Because it seems like a real open-ended problem.
Well, every contract has a cap, a maximum amount set on it. And as part of it, it varies depending on the firm and the services they're hired, but every contract sets a maximum amount, and it has a scope of work that has to be done under that contract amount. So the way we will manage that is the firm will have to provide a staffing plan that will forecast out the cost. We review the levels of staffing depending on what's happening at a point in time, because the workload will go up and down depending on what's going on with the program. They can't bring on people without getting approval, and they have to stay within their maximum price.
So you are controlling that?
Absolutely.
As part of the bid package, don't they tell you the number of employees that they have on staff?
Well, we're talking about professional services here.
Oh, okay.
So it's, as opposed to general contract.
Oh, okay.
Has there been any negative feedback for some of these that their overhead multiplier is more than 2% when it was cut down? I mean, is that not a problem then?
I think...
Because they were contracted under a certain amount.
I think Larry's point was there's been a lot of confusion about what the multiplier is for and how it works. And the point I was trying to make is there are many different compensation approaches mm-hmm. that a client can use. And you've used a number of different ones over time. And that's one of the things we're looking at here is what is the appropriate compensation approach going forward. But to answer your question specifically, one of the analysis that were done and presented to the board was to look at the salary that was being billed for this particular firms, and it was third-party studies done by three different firms that make their living trying to determining what are typical salary ranges in different markets. And all those analysis came back and said you can pay below market for the individual salary. So not only were you capping the multiplier, but you had a check that said, if I had these 10 positions coming in on an average for the LA market, am I paying at, above, or below? I came back and said, overwhelmingly, you were paying below what a typical salary was.
No problem.
Good to hear.
Are there any other questions?
Look at that.
We had the handout on it, and this was basically for information to inform us of the action of the Board of Trustees. All right. We now have 8 present. I believe we still need 9 for a quorum. So hopefully the wind will bring in someone else. Otherwise, we'll just discuss some items and no votes. Next would be the video update.
Can I? We could certainly do that. That will be take a fair amount of time. And I'm wondering that we really sort of are under the gun. We should look at our annual report draft. And
but we don't have to approve it?
We don't have to approve it, but if the committee had any further feedback, we could do an edit and basically circulate electronically.
I have no problems with that. The annual report is number 5. You've got one in your mail. I've been told there's a slight revision. I know I found a couple minor errors, but I still think it was beautifully done, and I thank you. And I think Reginald is to be congratulated on his letter. Hopefully all of you have read it. If not, could you take a few minutes? Does anyone need that few minutes? Oh, it is different slightly.
What's different?
Could I bring to your attention something? The draft that was circulated to the committee in advance of the meeting hadn't been reviewed by bond counsel or me prior to being circulated. And I think most of the edits that were done by bond counsel were typographical kinds of things. But there was one substantive change, and that was on the second, on what is page 3 of the report, in the first full paragraph at the end, there was a sentence that indicated the district was looking into the question of whether there was a need for remuneration of any funds that had been determined to have been spent inappropriately. And
right.
Bond counsel recommended taking that out because, in her opinion, there is no such legal requirement. And if the committee members want, I have a copy of her opinion available for you if you'd like to have that.
So what is the exact wording? Exact wording here?
The last sentence is just gone.
The first paragraph.
On page 3. The original document had the district is investigating its obligation or remuneration to repay funds. That sentence has been removed.
Yeah, and bond council was expressly opined that that such an obligation, there is no such legal obligation I've got a copy if the committee members would like to see her opinion to that effect so that you can be satisfied about that particular issue.
So she's saying that generically, that if funds are spent and determined to be spent not in accordance with Prop 39, that the projects would not have to be, or the money would not have to be refunded or repaid in some fashion.
Right. And like I said, I'd be happy to distribute her opinion to the committee that way that you have it and as you should.
May I ask a clarification question?
Sure.
So this last sentence was deleted because the district council viewed that opinion that we have no obligation.
Right.
Correct? Is that what it is?
That's right.
But yet, meanwhile, we still have a possibility by outside council, whoever other entity, saying that we do have obligation.
Well, this is. Bond council is outside council,
yes, outside
so she
council.
And I agree on this particular element. I think if what you're asking is there a potential of somebody making a different determination in litigation? Well, who knows what a court might rule someday somewhere, but there is no legal authority for that proposition.
But does that disallow the expenditures? This is saying there's nothing in there to require reimbursement, but was there anything in there that disallowed?
The sentence previous to that says, in response, staffing of the building program has been altered or eliminated further expenditures in these areas.
Right. So what it mandates is, in her opinion and mine, is the corrective measure of once identified to cease doing it, which of course we makes sense, but that there's not an affirmative duty of repayment.
So they can tell them to cease.
Right.
Okay. Well, descriptive notice, so to speak.
I have one, just, I think, as I say, this has been beautifully done. I have one editing thing, just because as I read it, and I'm not, my discipline was not English, so you can correct me if I'm wrong. On page 2, the last paragraph on page 2, the sentence goes on to talk about the 20% of expenses being soft and 78% hard. And then it says, this is well below national averages for building of this type. I think it probably needs to say soft costs are well below national average. It's like, what is this attached to?
Well, my thought on the soft cost was that in any project, your soft cost will be much higher at the beginning of a project, and it'll diminish.
Yeah, I don't have. It's just a grammar.
Yeah, you're right. It refers to hard cost and soft cost, and then it says
this. Yeah.
And you go, this what?
Yeah, that's why I went back and reread it.
So rather than that, you mean the soft
rather than
cost.
This, just put in the word soft costs, well below national averages of such and such. It's just.
No, but that's fine.
Well, it took me a little bit while to read it. The other question I had, there has been building done in the district offices. Has that been done under the bond issue?
Yes.
Is there no place in here does it make any comments to this? And I don't know if it needs to or not. It's just.
I guess the when did the work begin? In June?
We've done some of it all the way back
way back.
To
no, just thinking about the construction.
We had money under AA.
Yeah. I was just thinking about the construction started in June. Mm-hmm. So.
The current round, yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But the acquisition was done under AA.
Right. And some of the remodel of the ninth floor, for example, and the eighth floor mm-hmm. was done now, 2 years ago?
2006.
Three, four.
2006.
No,
2006, seven.
Anyway, there's no comment about anything on the district offices. I don't know if it's important or not. Somebody's liable to question that. Hey, I know you did this. Why isn't it on the due? That's just
a good point.
Yeah, that is a good point because beyond that, we have other projects that are not within the boundaries of a college allocation.
Mm-hmm.
So for example, our satellite project in the city of Southgate.
Right.
Is an example of that. But we have other satellite projects, other projects we've been working on. Measure J provided funding for a Health Career Academy project that would be ultimately go into a site at County General Hospital. And that's not a college-specific project. And we have spent some money to start initial due diligence on that effort. So we haven't reflected that. So that's a good point.
And we should probably just...
We should have basically a page of those projects and to report their current status. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Sure. And council's letter. Is she saying in the paragraph that starts with under the analysis, Article 13A, that in the last sentence, that there has been then no court actions that have been taken with respect to challenges as to the appropriate expenditures that have created any kind of precedent then?
I'm inferring that to be the case. It doesn't say that expressly, but I'm inferring that
she says in the back that in the absence right. of any other legal precedent.
Right. I'm not aware of any court opinion ordering any kind of repayment of funds. But you know, I Proposition 39 and its nuances remain largely untested legally, and so it really is about the exercise of best judgment.
Based on what this is, I got to believe if there was a court case, she would have said it.
Oh, absolutely. There's no doubt that she would do that as part of her diligence. What Mr. Berg was asking was, had there been any cases that ruled one way or the other? And I don't know the answer. I don't know the answer to that question as if there had been any cases, but I don't know of anything where there's been any affirmative ruling. And if there were a negative ruling, I'm sure she would have pointed to it. But under California law, a superior court decision wouldn't be binding on other courts. Well, it would have to be at the appellate level.
All right, we happen to have a quorum now.
All right. That's good business. Waiting for you.
I'm going to go back to where we are now. The annual report, are there any other comments? I see that she has made some corrections of the math, but that's very easy to do. I don't know if there were any others than the ones I caught. Okay, if some of you wanted to speak on this, this will be your opportunity to speak during this meeting. And again, how many public speakers are there? Just three of you, so 5 minutes each. Who will be our timer?
If I can figure out. This thing does so many things that I don't know how to do.
Well, I can look at my stopwatch.
Okay, I have a stopwatch here.
All right, who is first? For 5 minutes?
Well, I'm going to take a little time as I can. My name is Laura Gutierrez, and I'm with the Vandy Camps Coalition. And we see here that you are reviewing your annual report and looking at these two paragraphs on paragraph three. And you do issue the controversy of the Vandy Camps Innovation Center. The thing that I see that should be added in here is the fact that there is litigation pending. There are currently two lawsuits, one involving the California Environmental Quality Act and the other on taxpayer bonds. And there is an intent to sue on the indemnification that the district just applied for $500,000 to Portola Properties to purchase that land. You need to know, and like Scott Folsom said at the last meeting at Vandy Camps, that we are here and we are here to stay. It is your right, it is your duty to the taxpayers to let the taxpayers know that there is a problem here. And even though you are stating it, the report back here. I don't know where this woman's gym is. I mean, I think that needs to be specified because there is no gym there. There is an exercise room that was used, federal money was used. This is not only the problem of the district. We have been going out to the city, to the state, we've been to the county, and to the feds. There are misuse of funds, not only with bond money, but with federal ARRA, the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act. There are funds, there are irregularities with how this WorkSource Center went into that building. And there's a federal inquiry about that going on right now. So we are doing our due diligence as taxpayers to make sure that all our taxpayers' money is being spent properly. The people at Bell, the ones that were bringing up these issues, they're being put off, and we're not going to be put off as well. We don't have the massive riots that they're having at their county meetings because, amazing enough, they're held at night after work where people can attend meetings. Look at this. You could barely get quorum here this morning. The three of us were here, even though we put this out to certain members of our community that there was a meeting. You're not accessible to the community. Your outreach should be more open and transparent. Thank you.
Thank you very much. The next
thing. Jackson with the Vandy Camps Coalition. I fear that I must say that this report is a whitewash, at least as the bond issue regarding the Vandy Camps is concerned. For the rest of it, I have no idea. I find, for instance, right away here on page 3, this project was originally contemplated as a satellite. You know, you sit in a room and you contemplate. Well, that's not true. That's a weasel word. It was written into the legal language of the bonds which you oversee. Why would someone have such misleading, slippery language? It was planned, it was written in, and it's in countless documents, and all the weasel words and the whitewash the district can find to pour over this will not change that. But that is an indicator of how poorly they inform you. You need to get your own information. Because you can't trust theirs. Because we've proven it time and again, and we've offered you documents to prove it, and none of you have ever taken us up. And that's on the record. You just aren't interested enough. You won't work your own overtime enough, I think. Or something, I don't know. The focus on merely what is being built and has been built in this meeting, instead of discussing the bond and the monies and the dollar and cents so much, is skirting the issue of what was built illegally with bonds. They haven't told you. It's all, just something airy-fairy. You know, when you ask a specific question, you don't get a specific answer. I don't wonder about that. We give you specifics. We don't ask you just to believe our word. We offer documents. They don't come in with stacks of documents you could go through, and if you ask for it, they won't. On page 5, it says your role is to inform the public. Well, unfortunately, you have informed the public of nothing. The public have been informing you. And this is all going to come out. This is eventually going to come down. And the DCOC has a chance to look good or a chance to look bad. They have a chance to have people saying about them like they say about Bell, why didn't anybody say anything? Because we're talking about many millions of dollars in here. Instead, you are tied up with an endless duck and stall dance with the district, as illustrated in the minutes from the previous DCOC meeting. On page 1 of 6, Mr. Axelband again tried to get an answer about getting resources for the DCOC to get independent advice. He was told that would be dealt with later. On page 5 of 6, Mr. Axelband again tried to get information. The question was entirely ducked. If you read that carefully, Mr. Eisenberg never directly answers that. Then it winds up at the end that you all shouldn't have a special meeting, as Mr. Axelband again asked for, until the district responds. But no timetable is given for the district to respond. So the guardian of the hen house is told by the fox, just go away and leave it alone, and you know, when there's no more hens left, we'll call you back. So they're supposed to just wait forever.
And sadly, that means the DOCOC has completely failed in its mission. In the LA Times, City Controller Gruhl has put out the first part of her investigation into money for the works programs, and that's going to wind its way to the mayor's door.
You have about 1.5 minutes.
Okay. That's going to blow up on all of this. Now, one of my last questions to you, I went over there, I took pictures of the work source people in there, the archdiocesan people, the classes they're giving over there. They're here on my iPhone, anybody can look at them now, or I'll send them to you on email later. There's no lease for those people. No lease signed. Are they paying rent? How can they be paying rent with no lease? City hasn't signed the lease. It won't sign the lease because of the lawsuits, just like Portola Properties won't sell the property because of the lawsuits. Everything's held up, but you never heard anything about the lawsuits here. Isn't that interesting? So I'm going to ask you, is there rent being paid by those tenants? What are the indemnity issues of tenants over there with no lease? If any of you owned a commercial building, a tenant-based facility, is there? Mr. Eisenberg himself has described it. Wouldn't you want a lease before you put the tenants in there? Wouldn't you want some insurance indemnification? The capstone report has been done. It's discussed as done, and yet when we've asked for it in public records, we are expressly told it is not finished. I urge you not to approve this whitewash. I urge you to go back. I urge you to ask for facts and figures. Because if you pass this, that means you think everything's okay. There's no problems. Your names go on that. Your names go on that. My last question is, why is this signed by a person who has not been at almost any meeting I have ever been at, even though he is the chair?
Your time is up. Thank you very much. The third speaker?
Good afternoon, members. Daniel Wright on behalf of the Vandy Camps Coalition and taxpayers who have sued over the misuse of bond funds and violations of education code. The taxpayer and education code violations are alleged in the lease of the Vandy Camps building to the City of Los Angeles as a mere front for the ultimate sub-lessees of the building, workforce nonprofits, who under the education code are not lawfully eligible to receive a no-bid lease. We have been informed by the Atwater Park Center that they will refuse to sign a lease of the Child Development Center at Vandy Camps because under the current scheme, Atwater Park thinks that our taxpayer EDCO lawsuit is meritorious, and they do not want to buy into the risk of the likely success of that lawsuit. Let the record reflect that today I have submitted to this committee our letter dated September 17, 2010, and a copy of our August 24, 2010 intent to sue letter to the district. Today's letter recounts the growing concern that this committee, having known since December of 2009 of credible allegations of misuse of bond funds in the district and at the Vandy Camps site, has not issued a press release, has not obtained its own legal counsel or financial analyst, which this district is statutorily obligated to provide out of its general fund, if you ask. Last week, the board authorized the expenses of Sylvia Scott Hayes to attend a conference in Washington, D.C., presumably out of general funds. Yet, for three quarterly meetings in a row, this district has given this committee no answer to you, to your requests for funding of separate legal counsel and financial analysts. That travel budget is out of the general fund. There are funds available to you. Your draft annual report on page 3 states that you will await the report of the LECCD's Inspector General on the misuse of bond funds at Vandy Camps. The inspector is under the thumb of the district, hired by the district, and under their supervision. You need staff who not only have an allegiance to you, but allegiance to you so that you can insist that you get your own counsel and financial analyst. And that is now appearing to be an abdication of your duties if you don't demand such independent advice. Education code bars the service on this oversight committee of a district employee. Yet the district has appointed a former college employee whose person is whose work and pension comes through this district. In the 5 DOC meetings attended by the VDK Coalition, your designated chair has failed to attend any meeting, yet we see his willingness to sign the draft annual report. Instead, the district's past college president has chaired every meeting we've attended and chaired the ad hoc committee that rewrote the annual draft before you. Are you going to passively do nothing until the Inspector General is hired? As your staff drafted annual report says, are you going to wait for the Inspector General when you have the right under state law to demand independent advice? Finally, I turn to the notice to sue letter dated August 24th. The next taxpayer lawsuit that's coming will attack the language inserted at the end of Measure J. That language stated that the district would use bond funds to enter into, quote, public-private partnerships that benefit students and provide a stream of income to the district, close quote. The California Constitution expressly states that bond funds may only be used to purchase or lease real estate, quote, for school facilities. At Vandy Camps on December 16, 2009, this district voted to purchase the Portola property and said that they didn't have to do any environmental review because they have no current plans. That's called, and Mr. Eisberg stated to the board at that time that they were land banking. Land banking is illegal under Proposition 39. And especially because we have uncovered a pattern that this district is trying to buy land adjacent to many of its campuses and then put out RFPs to private developers to develop the properties, not for school facilities as required by Proposition 39, but to develop it as a profit-making center that will provide a multi-year, 30
seconds.
Thank you, a multi-year lease of the land to provide a, quote, stream of income for the district, as it says in Measure J. That language is unconstitutional. And this committee should be investigating, and you should be demanding outside legal counsel, you should be demanding an independent financial analyst to advise you. Otherwise, you're, as Vicky says,
I don't think
that you're going to look good in the public eye come further down the road.
Mr. Wright, thank you.
Thank you for your attention. And good luck. If we know it's a hard job.
Well, I have a question I've asked a couple times that relates to this situation. I call it the acid test question, which is one, I think I certainly appreciate your militancy in you bringing us information. We don't necessarily are not really in a position of evaluating it because we're independent citizens who are just here to represent the taxpayer, so to speak. But my question still is, what is your real objective here? I don't think anybody wants to spend money in lawsuits and all the hassle and all the brain damage. Is there something you want to accomplish? Is there an objective you have that can maybe be addressed rather than sit here and beat each other up over different things? And I just sense there's something there that is probably more important than the issues you're bringing to us. Is there something?
Well, we have to bring them to us.
No, I mean, if you...
Well, can you set aside...
I'll attempt to. I think we've attempted to make this clear before, which is that the promise to the voters by this board was to deliver, under this bond program, a satellite to City College. The district in 2009 declared, as it says on page 3 of your report, which you're now poised to adopt, language that says that the district, quote, determined that there were not sufficient funds in the budget to operate. We have given you, in previous meetings, copies of the COSMOT report from 2004 that documented that there was overwhelming demand for profit-making classes that would cover the operating costs of Vandy Camps and enable the opening of Vandy Camps even in a budget crisis. The district chose to not tell the truth, in our opinion, as to the reasons why they were trying to hand Vandy Camps off from LA City College to the district. We have an email from the head of... No,
okay.
I can't remember.
All right. Answer quickly.
We have an email from the guy...
I need to call a point of order. Number one, that's not an agenda item for discussion. This was a report given to us.
Right.
There is no discussion. We received the information, mm-hmm. and I think council can follow up, or they can be put on the agenda for next time. Point of order is there is no discussion on their presentation.
That's right. He asked the same question.
Well, there is a Vandy Camps item on this agenda, so if you'd like to bring it up during that agendized aspect.
You've already had your 5 minutes each.
If someone wants to ask us a question, we'll answer it.
All right.
Thank you.
Well, Council, you heard all of these issues. I know you were working on them and addressing them ad nauseum, I'm sure. Can you let us know where we stand with all these issues, or is it something you could summarize? Or
I think I can summarize it as follows. The coalition has a CEQA case that was filed, and the challenge is the purchase of the contiguous property to the site where we've built out the existing facilities, and that matter is pending. In addition to that, there are four taxpayers who are represented. If I'm misstating this, Mr. Wright, I apologize, but I believe they're represented by Mr. Wright and another law firm jointly, and have filed an action but not yet served the action that makes a taxpayer challenge to the expenditure of funds on the Vandy Camp site. So there are two civil actions pending already, although one has not yet been served on the district.
What's the basis of the CEQA? That there was something wrong with the EIR? Or?
The contention is that there was not, and I'm speaking in most general terms, there was not compliance with the requirements of the California Environmental Quality Act for the district to enter into the agreement to purchase the contiguous property. And I'm speaking in the broadest sweeping terms, and the district is represented.
Well, she's answering his question.
Yeah, the district is represented by Gresham and Savage on that matter.
I'm so far behind in this.
Your questions are fair, and it's good for us to hear it too, so that we know where we're coming from. Some of the issues, and maybe my opinion is wrong, related to lawsuits are lawsuits against the district, and they're against the board, and they're really not the concern, other than information, of this committee.
That was my other question.
we serve in a different capacity.
The committee doesn't have a separate legal capacity from the district. You don't have separate standing to sue or be sued. And the district has, on its own terms, imposed an obligation to provide defense and indemnity to its citizens, oversight committee members that are at the colleges, as well as the DCOC. But the DCOC isn't, to the best of my knowledge, named in any of those actions.
Because it's not our
501c3 or anything.
No.
We're just a group of people.
You're just a committee that's actually advisory to the Board of Trustees.
And we're interested in, we're to oversee the construction and physical hard assets of this project, not the soft, I don't use the word soft, but not the operational costs.
No, it's not ours.
This committee's responsibility is the entirety of the bond expenditures.
He's getting clarification that may help discussions in the future, because we've kind of got offline several times by lack of knowledge. Okay, can we quickly go back and approve the minutes of 5:14 and 7:08? I've read mine. Anybody have a motion to approve of 5:14? Any discussion? Second, all those in favor?
Well, I got a discussion. I was not here. I was here for 5:14, not for.
Okay, we're doing 5:14.
So I have to abstain 5:14.
I'm only doing 5:14.
Okay.
Excuse me, on page 6.
Abstention.
I have a correction. It says another speaker. I was the other speaker.
Okay, because you must have not introduced yourself. She will make that note, right, Laura?
Thank you.
Okay. May I have, I have to count votes, so all those approved, all of those who are in favor?
Did you get a motion in a second?
I think I did.
Yes. Okay, yes. Sorry, I was reading something.
I believe I did.
Okay.
Yes. Okay, let's start out.
Sorry, I was reading
something. Mrs. Chum?
No, I thought we were ready to vote.
Okay, yes. All those in favor?
Of 5:14.
Of 5:14. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. All right. Abstaining? 3, 4 abstaining. All right, that's 9. No negative votes then. Let's look at the minutes of 7:08. I may have had something on that. My only thing on it is that it should reflect that we met on the Vandy Camp site rather than at the district. I don't see that it says it. I I think it should reflect that the site of the meeting was the Vandercamp campus satellite.
All right, so I'll add that in there. Probably at the top, I'll just add a little...
Across, yeah, agency met at, yeah. Any other corrections, additions? All those in favor of accepting the minutes of 7-8, please raise your hands. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. All of those negative?
Abstaining.
Abstaining? And 8, and 3. Should be one more vote. 4. 4. All right, let's get rid of that. The meeting calendar, it's in here also, the dates of the meeting calendar. I have a preference, but you don't have to take mine into consideration.
There was a typo. It was supposed to be May 13th.
May 13th, yes.
Are all these always from noon until 2?
Yes.
Yes, as much as possible.
Okay.
Since we have been having trouble of getting quorums, I know I will not be here on February 18th. I don't know if there is a preference of another date, or we'll just forget that I won't be here.
I don't plan that far in advance. So.
Sorry. I only have so many years to live. I haven't planned that. Other than that, my only thing is saying that if it's a problem for quorum, I know I'm not going to be here then.
A sheet of paper that was in your package.
It was right after the agenda.
What's your name?
No, it was in your package.
It was in your package.
Yeah.
Oh, here it is. It's small.
Oh.
It was right after the agenda.
Nancy, yep. Is it appropriate to ask general question about our... this committee membership and chair and election of chair and co-chair?
I can. Go ahead.
Yeah, because first of all, is Nancy, you are the co-chair, right?
Second,
while
yeah.
Regional is?
Regional, yeah.
Okay, so we always have two.
Right, there's a chair and a vice chair. I believe the provisions call for an annual election, if I'm not mistaken.
I think that was what I'm going to ask.
And yes. I can't remember when we elected.
You had that, okay.
Yeah, this year.
I believe, yeah, I was going to say.
I think January or February.
Doing January.
Yeah, I think it's usually done at that meeting.
Start of the calendar year.
Is Reginald going to have a hard time showing up for the meetings? I do think that's an honest point, even though he's been elected the president of the committee, but he's missed most of the meetings I've been here.
Because you want to do it in February of election, and Nancy, you're not going to be here, and pending, you know, so...
Is there a rule where we could ask for his resignation or ask for his stepping down as chair, and we do a re-election of a new leader? Because I do think we're a little bit headless here.
Thank you.
I don't think you can make up rules as you go. I think we need to review the bylaws, mm-hmm. and we need to see if they're addressed in the bylaws. If not, then it needs to be done that way. Mm-hmm. But I don't think we can arbitrarily make up rules as we go.
No, I'm not making up the rule. I'm asking council.
Well, when you ask for somebody to resign a position.
No, I'm just asking council.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I don't happen to have them with me here today. I'm remiss in that respect. But I will take a look and provide a report to you.
Yeah.
I believe that we included a provision in the bylaws about missing a certain number of meetings.
Generally, there would be something,
Is there a certain time that works better for other people? If there's
I just am out of town. I'm out of the country. I just have to know that. The one thing I noticed, though, is that December 17th is 3 months from now, and February 18th is 2 months after that, and then we get into May. Are we supposed to be every 2 months, every 3 months, every whatever months we want?
It's typically been, there's a summer recess that typically takes place. And so basically it's meeting every 3 months basically into the January. Right. And so two meetings on either side of the summer recess.
I think a resolution to that also is that you can look at the bylaws and see if a provision, we can put them up on this December. Most of the committees are served on, that's when we do it.
The bylaws do provide for quarterly meetings, but in court, that gives you a little latitude one way or the other. I mean, it doesn't have to be regimented. And then the Brown Act requires you to adopt a meeting calendar once a year, which is one of the reasons, besides that and planning, or why you have it in front of you.
Right. We can look at that for next time.
Okay, I'm going to do something that isn't right there. I'd like to know if everybody can accept the December 17th date.
I will not be here.
Okay, so what was that?
If everybody can do what?
I'll be here.
Okay, the December 17th date. That's 3 months from today, essentially.
That's hard to know. I mean, things come up between now and December, so.
Yeah.
Is it always on Thursday?
Yeah.
Do we always meet on Thursday?
No, Friday.
Oh, Thursday.
You had a question, though, relative to, someone did a relative to this timing of these meetings?
Yeah.
You know, is there a preference for the board to have it after work? Is that more convenient or not?
It makes no difference to me.
People have meeting commitments, too, so I don't know what's most convenient for everyone.
Six on one half.
My one at my own college meets at 6 o'clock, so I.
The only reason that's good about at least through the noon hour is if there are members of the public who want to be able to come, it is time when they could probably get away.
But when? During the day or after?
During the noon hour, as opposed to 9 to 12 or 1 to 5 or something like that.
Or we could even do it at 6.
After hours, great. Yeah. I think a comment was made that it may be more convenient for the public to come.
I think you're running the probably more complications. I would think so. Particularly on a Friday.
Yeah, you certainly can't do it Friday at 6.
Yeah.
We always have Fridays.
It's always been on Friday that I've been
here, though I thought today was Thursday.
I don't want to struggle with this, but perhaps we can agree to meet on December 17th and then put together a calendar at that time that we find out what people's attendance are. Maybe we can put out an email that puts down some things on some preferences and also preferences for time. And then set the calendar and time at that time if that's all right with this group. Okay? And Yvonne, please respond on the email since you're not going to be here.
I put in all the rest of the dates.
Yeah. I keep a calendar going way ahead because that means I'm going to be living then. If I've got it planned, I'm going to be there. I'm sorry. So December 17th, and please respond to the email. I'm not always fast as on it, but respond if you have preferable dates and times so we know where we're at. Anytime's all right with me. I can't do much about my dates. Okay. Come down. The annual report, the people that were not here when we were discussing it, did you have any other comments?
Except for the particulars on this Vandekamp thing, which I'm not that aware of, it seemed pretty good to me.
I think that the dates here, it's one thing that was missing that needs to be there, and then the data is very comprehensive in a summary form. I don't think we're ever going to get quite the weird wording that's going to please everybody. Reggie was at all of the meetings when this was being worked on. It was there were four of us that made up the subcommittee, and he was
responding.
Yeah, he was at all those meetings and worked.
What's the deadline for this, though?
Any date we want it. One has not been published for several years, and this represents the end of the 8-9 year. Those reports came in January of 2010, so this should be out this year.
So if there's a desire of the members, since we do have a quorum now, we can literally vote
to publish,
to adopt it.
Perfect.
Okay, so I move that we adopt this as our report.
With
okay.
The changes noted today.
With the changes noted.
Is there a second?
Second.
Okay, there's been a move motion and a second to adopt this report reflects the 08-09 audit. Are there all those in favor? Please signify by raising your hand. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Therefore, there's no Doing our best. Got you three things done. 2 minutes. Okay. What else? Let's see. You want to wait the video for a bit. Any questions on number 9, the dashboard reports? These you received. It's the summary of what's going on at each college. I thank you. They're wonderful. For me, I enjoy looking at them.
And,
the numbers.
And they are available online as well.
And I have my binder at home. I just got back from Oregon. Haven't done anything. Got a chance.
I think there at last meeting there was a question regarding the expenditures. Someone was asking my project, and so they're just going to clarify what's in the dashboard report to take it clear.
Yeah, it's each project, where it's at, what's expenses.
Yeah, someone was saying that they didn't think that there was, they wanted to see an accounting separate, and I don't think they realized it was in the dashboard.
Yeah, because each project reflects its original budget as well as then basically actual expenditures and the so-called remaining budget unspent at this point. Mm-hmm. So that's the nature of the dashboard report. So yeah, and we do, and the whole idea, of course, is that it rolls up so that we add up all the college projects, that creates the college level summary, and all the college level summaries create the district-wide summary as part of that. So, and this is basically produced and updated once a month. So you can always find what's a pretty current version on the web, and we send you the current version as a mailing.
Larry, what I've asked for a number of times, number of meetings, you know what I'm going to say. I think this is excellent. It's really well done. It's basically, to me, a checkbook report. This is how much we started with, this is how much we have left, which doesn't tell me a thing as far as an oversight member of this committee. I'll tell you what I would really like to see is highlights and lowlights, you know, of the last 3 months or whatever time frame you want to do. You can say, in this period of time, this is how great we're doing. However, we had these problems and we addressed them this way. And we had these successes and we addressed them this way. Because for me, having been on many boards, it isn't the information you give us, but it's letting me know how well the staff is handling problems, how you handle them. It's more, to me, evaluation of staff competency and how well they're on top of everything. So I just think to be able to see highlights and lowlights, because it can't be this perfect. I mean, this is $8 billion. Come on. We've got to.